Right. Good morning, everyone. As you know, we will be having the presentation of the eighth edition, the sort of iteration of Industrial Policy Action Plan, which was recently launched in Benoni this year. Unfortunately, we were all in session and working, so it wasn't possible for us to attend per se. But the DDG, Garth Stockton, will be outlining that for us with his colleague from IDD, Mrs. Kiswa Mkapai. Is that right? Thank you. Now, the other issue I want to raise here in the opening is we're due to close at 1300. One would like to try and make this as soon as possible a sort of attend to. I myself have another committee that requires my attention at that time. And we need to go through all the minutes, and we need to do that immediately now while we've got a quorum, as soon as we've adopted this agenda. Otherwise, after that, we will be dealing with the briefing by DDI. This was distributed, the minutes, but the hard copies are not with you. They are with you. Have you got it, Honourable Mantash? Have you got it, Honourable Hill Lewis? Come to bring down 1, 2, 3, 4. Four. We don't need all of them. As soon as possible. So we can just raise one thing. It's absolutely critical that we not only do a full rollout of this, Industrial Policy Action Plan, which I am hoping will take 2 hours, okay, unpack it, so 9:30, 10:30, 11:30, and then to look at the terms of reference of the colloquium, per se. So that being the case, we can't just kick into the minutes, unfortunately, because not everyone has got them with them, but as soon as possible. So I'm making appeal to DDG Stockton that perhaps in between, after your presentation and in between those questions or the responses, we could do the minutes, as it were, at 11. And on that note, I want to also put forward to you a position that if we do not complete these critical issues, I hope you're listening, if, and there are matters outstanding that must be addressed, even after this meeting, then it may be necessary to have a 2-hour meeting on Friday, 8:30, 9:30, 10:30. It may be necessary. So it's entirely up to you. This matter is in your hands. Tomorrow we are with finance, as you know. So effectively, this was going to be our last meeting. And I need to make that very clear. So if there's anything outstanding, it will need us to meet on Friday for 2 hours. On that note, I also want to welcome members of the Economic Portfolio Committee on Economic Development. They'll be coming in. Some now are here, some at 9:30, and perhaps some a little bit later. But already we have the Honourable Gliani here. Thank you very much. You're welcome. And on that note, will you, the apologies have now been reduced. Honourable MacPherson is here. The Honourable Ngongi is arriving late. He's attending an ad hoc committee. The Honourable Elvis is arriving late. His flight was delayed. Otherwise, we are all here, as we are, where the Honourable Shimambu is serving after a suspension in terms of EEFF and the speakers to say. someone to adopt, to propose the adoption of the agenda? Thank you, Honourable Munter. Seconded by the Honourable McPherson. We then move immediately, seeing as we're waiting for those 6 minutes, to yourself, GDG Strachan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sukisa and Natai is the Chief Director in this proposal and does much of the heavy lifting. And so I'll do the presentation and between the two of us we would answer questions. Since the Honourable Members received the Industrial Policy Action Plan, I assume about a week ago, perhaps I'll cherry pick key issues in the presentation and not go line by line, which will take a great deal of time, hopefully give a flavour of what we're trying to do. I think it's important to note the fact that successful industrialisers, industrial policy is not the function of one department. In successful industrialized countries like Japan or South Korea, recent examples include Vietnam and Ethiopia, industrial policy and industrial strategy is driven across government departments, and this is why it's important to make the point that the ARPA is a product of the economic sectors, employment and infrastructure development cluster. And perhaps it's important to make the point that in keeping with many other governments worldwide, perhaps the biggest challenge is intra-governmental policy coordination and program alignment. It might not be an accident that where we achieve significant outcomes, very often the number of departments involved, for example, in autos or clothing and textiles, is limited. So that would be the first observation. I'm not sure how much time members want me to give to the policy context. As the chairperson has said, this is the eighth iteration of the IPEP. We often get this question that every year we're developing a new policy. It's not a new policy, in fact, it's an action plan. And we are trying to learn by doing, build capacity in the state, and increasingly, what Kenichi Ono, the famous industrial policy expert from Japan, who we had here recently said, we are learning to industrialize in a collaborative arrangement with the private sector in South Africa. And there isn't a quick fix, actually speaking. It's a very difficult and complex process. Obviously, as part of the medium-term strategic framework, including the funding and part of the President's 9-point plan. The next important point to make is that industrial policy programs and strategy in South Africa is perhaps even more difficult than it would be in other countries because of the very deep structural fault lines that we have in our economy. It is energy intensive. In the past, industrialization was driven in a so-called minerals energy complex. There are very deep-seated skills problems, very significant structural problems. And so each successive IPEP keeps on the table, so to speak, the issue of addressing these very deep structural problems, of course, including the fact that ownership and equity are a very big problem in our economy. Increasingly, the IPEP has recognized the fact that we can do regulation either in a top-down approach, or we can secure regulation which is part of a collaborative approach with the private sector, and increasingly that has been emphasized in successive iterations of IPA. The last point I want to make is that we obviously aren't working on a blank slate. The global economic conditions change every year and change absolutely, sometimes fundamentally. And this year's IPA takes place against very, very difficult global economic conditions. Minister Davies has referred to this the great global recession of the recent past has had successive aftershocks, and the aftershocks that we are experiencing now is the fact that we are at the bottom of the global commodity boom, and there's a massive crisis in the steel sector, which is affecting resource-dependent economies across the globe, and not just South Africa. So, Madam Chair, again, I'm not sure how much you want me to go through this in the detail. We've selected some of the highlights. At the very end of the presentation is a list of all the new leather and footwear factories that have been opened over the last 2 years in South Africa. In our opinion, this has been driven by private sector dynamics, entrepreneurial approach to unlocking considerable opportunities, together with the fact that we deployed in a very close working relationship with the sector a whole set of policy instruments. And we have, in addition to that, in addition to all the incentives, I think the sub-national clusters are really functioning very well. And the key issue in those clusters is that across the value chain, from textiles to apparel manufacturers to the retailers, supported by incentives, there is a world-class manufacturing capabilities developing in a vertically integrated program. And the important thing about this, I think, is that it leads to a large number of examples, positive examples, which we can cascade and are cascading across other sectors. I won't go into all the detail of those highlights, and perhaps move on to business process services. As everybody knows, this has been a very successful part of our industrial policy action plan.
Mr. Strachan, I notice now you're going on to BBS, and you've got some dates there. Whereas on slide 6 here, the clothing, textile, footwear, leather issue, effectiveness, it would have been helpful for us if we knew the kind of time period that we saved, or you saved 67,000 jobs. You know, are we looking at 10-year period, or what is that particular period? Some idea on that. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a good point. And bullet point number one on clothing, textile, footwear and leather is since the inception of the clothing, textiles, competitiveness program, which is 2008. And I beg your pardon for that omission. Madam Chair, again, I don't know whether to go into all the detail on the business process services. The slide speaks for itself. I think the critical point to make is in relation to business process services that we are working very closely with the private sector to scale up the offering in other words, front of office call service capabilities have done well, but we need to move to back office, higher knowledge intensity call service provision, where India and Egypt have moved into, as well as the Philippines, into different markets, and we are working very closely with the private sector to build those capabilities. Everybody again knows the achievements in relation to film and the number of jobs that are supported and investments since 2004 in film, and I won't go into detail there again. Agro-processing, Madam Chair, is an area where we believe much more needs to be done. We established a team at the DGI. We are very mindful of the fact that we need to get labor intensity increased, and agro-processing, using examples of other countries, is where you can achieve most labor intensity, as well as component suppliers to autos, rail, and so on and so forth. We are working very closely with the major global multinationals to ensure that in their supply chains we achieve greater levels of value addition and, of course, labor intensity. And as everybody knows, there have been significant investments by a range of agro-processing companies in this space. Moving on to metal fabrication, capital and rail transport equipment, Madam Chair, there's an issue around how we do the presentation, because sometimes we put some of these achievement highlights under procurement, when in fact they also sit in, for example, capital and rail transport equipment. We think, and the minister made this point when he launched the IPA, that we've gone as a country a very long way to rebuilding our rail industrial capabilities. And we've done so in very close coordination with the large companies, General Electric, Bombardier, Grindrod Rail, in their supply chains. And in South Africa now, for the first time ever, we now have the capacity at IEC Holden to make a traction motor for a rail locomotive, and other companies there are, and some of them are black owned, there are the capabilities to make the actual motor itself, and the drivetrain, as well as critical components in the rail supply chain. And many of these companies supported by the DTI are black owned. Madam Chair, in green industries, everybody is aware of the fact that our renewable independent power producer program has been very successful. More of a challenge has been securing localization in that. Our estimation is that there's been 1.7 billion investment in the manufacturing of equipment and components. We believe that it should be much higher. The critical issue is to smooth demand in the program, because the demand is lumpy and goes up and down, and manufacturers require raising aggregate demand and smoothing demand, which remains a big challenge. We are working very closely with the Independent Power Producer Office, which falls under the Department of Energy, and we are well on course to achieve higher levels of localization, working closely with the IPP office, including in relation to the rollout of the gas-based industrialization strategy, which I'll speak to in a short while. Madam Chair, everybody probably also knows about the achievements in the automotive sector, and we've get there. The private sector investment over the last 5 years is close to 26 billion, and the number of companies that have invested. As everybody knows, the critical challenge is to secure stronger localization in the supply chains. We are working very closely with all the automotive manufacturers to secure greater levels of localization in their supply chains, supported by a program called ESCI in the DTI, which supports supplier companies. And then, Madam Chair, as has been announced, we have set up the APDP, the present program, comes to an end in 2020. We have set up a task team which is driven by Professor Justin Brons and Professor Anthony Black of the University of Cape Town. It includes senior DTI officials led by Chief Director Nkululi Mbota. For the first time, we have established not only a task team to do this work for a post-2020 Autos Master Plan, but we've established an Executive Oversight Committee, and this Executive Oversight Committee is chaired by the Minister and has representatives of the automotive industry. NASA are represented, NARCAM are represented, and those are the component manufacturers, and labor is also represented. The critical question is, we've got to plan long-term in automotives. 2020 might seem a long way away. In the investment and production cycles of automotive manufacturers, this isn't actually a long time away, and some of the investment decisions go beyond 2020. The critical issue is to provide policy certainty for investment in automotives, to ramp up localization, to begin the possible production of motorcycles in South Africa, and have a much stronger focus on light, heavy, and medium commercial vehicles, and most importantly of all, to use South Africa as a production hub for exports into mainly the rest of Africa. And as you would have seen, our automotive export figures in an otherwise sometimes gloomy environment, our automotive export figures, which include exports of luxury vehicles to OECD countries, mainly by the two German manufacturers, has been sustained and has even been growing through the recession.
Mr. Rockham, just a little bit earlier on slide 15, given that there are other members of the committees here, but also new members, OEM may be familiar to half of the committee and not the other what it stands for, and ASCII. Can you explain what ASCII is? I took it that it was in Alaska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. OEMs are original equipment manufacturers, and these are global companies such as Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen, Nissan, and so on and so forth. And automotive manufacturers, known as original equipment manufacturers, produce some components for assembly, and they produce some components in South Africa, but they have global supply chains. In other words, they can source whatever it is, a carburetor or the harness of all the wires going from the transmission through the vehicle from other parts of the world. These are known as global supply or value chains. Countries which are at the on the technology and production curve globally have high levels of localization. In other words, first, second, and third tier suppliers to those original equipment manufacturers are companies based in this case, in South Africa. And they either provide one component, which is then sourced from another tier of supplier, and so let's take a part of a vehicle, let's say a gearbox. One company might produce some of the gears, another company might produce the casing for the gearbox, another company might produce the automatic transmission or the gear stick itself, and these have to be put together in the supply chain and delivered on time to the required specification at the right price at the original equipment manufacturer's factory gate, so that these go onto the assembly line and these are then assembled as part of the vehicle. The ASCII stands for Automotive Supplier Competitive Initiative, and this initiative works, it's based in the DTI. The colleagues in this team work closely with the original equipment manufacturers. They also work closely with the component manufacturers. They also work closely with the national automobile components manufacturers, NARCAM, and the critical question there is to ensure that support is given to these companies, including support on the factory floor, to be able to produce the components, whether it's a widget, a piece of plastic for the dashboard, or a high value added product. They need to be able to produce that product to required standard specification price on time using so-called lean or world-class manufacturing capabilities. As everybody knows, apart from an aircraft or a rocket or very high value added products in the aerospace sector, for example, the ability to produce an automotive with all of its industrial complexities, the supply chain, the specifications, the lean manufacturing capabilities, which have to be globally competitive. If a country is able to produce automotives, this is a hugely important industrial capability. Australia has just closed the door on the last factory in Australia, and that's essentially because of the fact that all incentives were drawn for original equipment manufacturers. We believe that that's the wrong way to go. There are what are, in economic terms, enormous economic spillovers from the automotive sector. For example, in the entire supply chain, a huge number of highly skilled technicians and engineers are, so to speak, incubated. And very often, you can't take an individual off the street to set up an SME who's going to supply a component to the original equipment manufacturers. Most often, it's an engineer or a technician working on an assembly line or in the supply chain who has the technical capabilities to go and set up an SME to be able to get into this very high value adding sector. Madam Chair, I don't know whether that's sufficient of an explanation.
Thank you, that is sufficient, but I'd also like to take the opportunity of welcoming the Chair of the Portfolio Committee of Economic Development, Matulai, and also we did acknowledge the Honourable Ali Tiani. We'd also like to acknowledge Honourable Katrin Matsumbi. Thank you very much. Right, do proceed.
Energy in chemicals, cosmetics, plastics, pharmaceuticals, there are very big overlaps in this. When we speak about a Unilever investment of 1.2 billion supported by a 12-hour tax allowance, of course, many of the Unilever products will not only be in the chemical supply chain, they will also be in the agro-processing supply chain. And so I'm just explaining that in the way we set these things out, it isn't easy to put things into neat boxes. And I'd say perhaps of note is that we are very close to a very significant investment in the Dubai Trade Port by Sidla. I think it's all been basically tied up for this investment to happen, and an announcement giving the detail will be provided shortly. Madam Chair, in beneficiation, we were in a 7-week mining pakisa with the mining companies and the manufacturers. The presidency will be making the announcements in due course, and it's not my prerogative to make any of those announcements at the moment, other than to say there's been very significant progress. Let me give you one example without getting myself into trouble. Recently, one of the major mining houses has announced an 800 million purchase agreement to buy mining capital equipment from a South African black-owned mining company. As I said at the beginning of my presentation, we can pass regulations which are top-down and which the private sector very often doesn't like, or we can get into the room with the private sector to say, what is the regulation that you can live with and work with, and can you put skin in the game instead of buying your capital equipment from an overseas original equipment manufacturer of mining equipment? Can you buy it from a local company, and we have global capabilities in South Africa to produce mining capital equipment, and we are exporting it to the rest of South Africa? Can you come to the table in relation to buying your equipment from South African companies in your own interests as well, because in short supply lines you can be very close to your supplier for maintenance and spare parts, and you can specify exactly what kind of modifications you require to the equipment. But here's an example, Madam Chair, of why intergovernmental coordination and policy coherence is absolutely critical. The mining charter hitherto has not required localization from mining companies which get mining licenses through the NPRDA. As we speak, the mining charter is out there for public consultation. But unless we get sign-off on the mining charter, unless it includes localization requirements as well as black economic empowerment requirements, then we're still going to sit in a situation where mining companies who have multi-billion rand procurement spend are importing these products. We believe there should not be a Chinese wall between empowerment and localization, but we need intergovernmental coordination to achieve that. And that would be a very good example where that hasn't been achieved between the economic department. Madam Chair, The fuel cell technology has been a lot in the room. We are working closely with the Department of Science and Technology. We're working very closely with global fuel cell manufacturers, which include Fuji, Doosan, and Ballard. And we have a number of both static and mobile fuel cell technology pilot projects in place. We think that this could be a global competitive advantage for South Africa and have the additional benefit of the fact that it would raise aggregate demand for platinum in our country and then therefore ensure that platinum mining is given a boost. Madam Chair, upstream oil and gas, there was recently an announcement. We have been doing research for the last 1.5 years on oil and gas. We are awaiting a final submission to the minister. The research has been done by a team of private sector technical experts, including experts who have been responsible for gas-based industrialization in countries such as Qatar, and Australia, and so on and so forth. The minister will be announcing shortly the composition of that team. In oil and gas, of course, we're not just doing the research, but we are in parallel working closely with the RTP office, the Independent Power Producer Office of the Department of Energy, which works closely also with the National Treasury. We are working with Transnet and Transnet National Ports Authority, and the first RFPs for the import of liquid natural gas have gone out for Saldanha Bay, Richards Bay, and Kocha. That's the first stage of a gas-based industrialization strategy, is to import the gas to assist in the creation of a gas market, especially for industrial uses. The next stage is, of course, the possibility, and there are very significant hurdles, and the main hurdles are the cost of the investment to bring the liquid natural gas in the fourth biggest reserves in the world, which is the Rovuma Basin in Mozambique, that will require either a pipeline or sea carriage to Richards Bay of liquid natural gas, and that's a longer term piece of work. And then we are also working with a much longer term horizon, including working closely with the Department of Science and Technology, and in relation to the exploration that is happening already for the possibility of shale gas, especially using new technologies, including waterless fracking technologies. So, Madam Chair, those are some of the highlights. My understanding is that the progress in relation to the Saldanha Bay is significant. There are 36 companies in the investment pipeline. There are one or two hurdles still to be overcome. That is that includes the back of port land use, regulatory burden, regulatory loops that have to be jumped through, but already, as we have seen, by way of the investment by Hunting, this opportunity is being assessed. Madam Chair, this falls under Zuki, in fact, who is multitasking in the DGI. When I first arrived at the DGI, our boat building sector was in deep distress. I noticed today that the 25th anniversary of Robertson and Cain, which is the biggest luxury recreational boat builders in South Africa, not only are in the middle of the global recession, have we continued to build the luxury recreational vehicle sector, but we are now getting back into creating small working boats, and procurement has been the critical instrument, so nine of the tugboats which were ordered by the Transnet National Ports Authority for the first time for 30 years are being built in South Africa by South African companies and South African ports, supported by infrastructure investment and incentives and raising aggregate demand by using the procurement instrument. This is an example, I think, and thanks to Suki and her team, where we are seeing cooperation between the DGI and Transnet, the deployment of policy instruments, and utilizing industrial capabilities that had not been entirely lost to rebuild our boat building sector. Madam Chair, localization. Can I say first also that we are very grateful that the committee is going to have a colloquium in this regard. Those are all the items that we have designated for local procurement. Procurement has to be a program. If it was a quick fix destination, we would have arrived at the destination. It's common cause that across government departments and SOEs and vertically across spheres of government, there is still a lack of compliance. There is inadequate compliance in some sectors of government departments and SOEs, and sometimes it's good ranging to not so good at all, including in rail, in energy, and all of the designations. It's very important in our view that this does become a clearly articulated audit function. I think we are haven't also forgotten the fact that unless you build strategic sourcing and supply development capabilities in government, you can pass lots of regulations, but they might not be implemented, and you've got to build those capabilities in the state, which is why, quite frankly, at the moment, the procurement team probably spends 90% of their time going to municipalities, to government departments, to provincial governments, to build the strategic capabilities that we have talked about. We said it over and over again, Madam Chair. The procurement accords, which were signed in 2011, which commits the private sector to local procurement, have, in my opinion, achieved very little traction. And it gets back to what I think I was saying at the beginning. If you perhaps hold a gun to the heads of the private sector, they still might not come to the table. The private procurement accords were signed, but actually there's been very little traction. We've moved to a situation rather of getting the private sector to buy into the procurement, working closely with the original equipment manufacturers, bringing, for example, mining companies together with manufacturers, bringing original equipment manufacturers in aerospace together with the component suppliers, and to build partnerships and relationships for localization and empowerment might be as important in this space. Madam Chair, we've reported in the past on the achievements in the locomotives. I know you're planning a colloquium on this, and so I won't repeat all those highlights there. Madam Chair, in industrial financing, I think we still have a long way to go to put in place a better, stronger system of industrial financing, incentives and export credits. But I think the data suggests that a huge amount of progress has been made, including in relation to working very closely with the IBC and the disbursement of their industrial financing, which is different to the incentives which are administered in the main by the DTI, but in some cases by DST and in other cases by the National Treasury. We are starting a very big piece of work with the Development Bank of South Africa. The data is sometimes, contradictory. I noticed that Business Day said that the Development Bank of South Africa, by value, was supporting the biggest number of and value of big projects in Africa. One area where we need to do much more work is where other countries' financial institutions are supporting big infrastructure projects in Africa. The conditionalities for that finance, as well as processes to ensure that engineering and service companies and manufacturing companies from South Africa are pulled behind that financing, is a critical area of work that we have to explore. Madam Chair, we give data for the NEF, the NSEP, the AIS on slide number 27, the Enterprise Development Program, the 12-hour tax allowance, and our agriculture development and enhancement program. Can I just say we are working on moving away from an open architecture process where, such as the Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program, where we supported companies across the sectors, to a sector-specific incentive program, and we are working on incentives for the foundry industry, the rail supply chain, and value-added agro-processing sectors. Hopefully by the time we meet next year, we will have those incentives in place. Critical to any discussion on incentives, as we have also repeatedly said, is the conditional reciprocity. In other words, we've got to build this capability. If we say to company X, you can have an incentive, provided that you meet empowerment targets, employment targets, export targets, and raise your competitiveness, is our capacity and capability to check that they are actually doing that fully in place? I would say we've got to do a lot more work to ensure that this is the case. And we are doing this, as the colleagues probably know, we've established an Africa Export Council. We are mapping all the companies across all the sectors which are exporting, which countries they are exporting to, what products they are exporting. We are working closely with the private sector to ensure that our export credit insurance capabilities are built. And we find that very often the private sector is able to provide export credit, but the cost of that financing is very high, and we find that we need to work with them in relation to interest make-up schemes and risk mitigation for export credit. This is a very big piece of work, which I'll talk to in a moment. Madam Chair, foreign investment, here we are speaking about, and this is not our division, we're speaking about not mergers and acquisitions and takeovers, but investment in the productive sectors, specifically the manufacturing sector of the economy, and what notwithstanding analysts sometimes erring perhaps on the side of doom and gloom, our view is that investment in the manufacturing sector could be doing better, but actually there are very many positive indications that investment is taking place, and those are the examples we give. We also give examples in the IVZ. Madam Chair, I suppose just as an example of how these things take time, we started raising perhaps 4 years ago on the Industrial Policy Action Plan the fact that high tariffs for exports out of South African ports was a major problem. We got into a very long conversation with Transnet and the Transnet National Ports Authority and the port regulator, and as honourable members would have seen, in fact we are now beginning to achieve real traction, and cargo dues for the export of value added products are now being held at a constant, and in fact there is a movement away from the previous practice where the cheapest thing to do was to export primary commodities out of South Africa. The critical thing that we have to work our way around together with Transnet is the issue of the fact that we need to do that to ensure at the same time that Transnet's demand strategy, including financing for infrastructure, isn't adversely impacted as we begin the difficult process of adjusting the tariff regime at the ports. Madam Chair, perhaps to move on from the key highlights to the key themes, I think the first key theme is to build on the policy platforms of existing programs which have been successful. We still think, notwithstanding sometimes suggestions that we should have a so-called lighter touch industrial policy, that at the center of our industrial policy should be to use the full array of industrial policy instruments to build on existing capabilities, to identify where we have competitive capabilities and advantages, to work very closely with global OEMs and domestic champions across the sectors, and to focus on labor-intensive sectors, which we will be doing increasingly going forward. To concentrate also on the new sectors, the oil and gas, the locomotive capabilities that we've built, our mining capital, equipment, heavy commercial vehicles and shipbuilding, and in public procurement, this is perhaps the strongest lever that we have. As I've said, to try and ensure compliance and enforcement, closer alignment of all the policy levers. There's designation, there's a competitive supplier development program, there's the National Industrial Participation Program. That's an area where we are committed to massively scaling up our efforts in this regard, which to some extent has been less than optimal. We, as I've said, are working on the industrial financing and incentives, and with all these things that I'm saying, I suppose to state the obvious, we've got an open door. If there are other suggestions on the table, we would be happy to entertain them. Madam Chair, as I've also said, we have to leverage a competitive advantage for the devalued currency, which is why we're now placing a particular emphasis on exports, a particular emphasis on exports to Africa, a particular emphasis on exports of agro-processed products, which are being pulled to some extent or to a large extent by the fact of retail expansion into South Africa, into the rest of Africa. We have to also concentrate on exports of rail, locomotives, rolling stock and components, automotives, chemicals, especially household chemicals, which are significantly up, and then, of course, steel and fabricated products in the infrastructure build programs in Africa. We have to, of course, do that by deploying a set of incentives, including the 12R, which has supported many of the investments, including in agro-processing, and the SEZs, and the IDZs, and our cluster programs to support investment and exports, using, as I said at the beginning, the very good examples of the clusters in clothing and textiles. Madam Chair, if I might recommend to the committee, it would be perhaps a useful thing to ask the Technology Localization Unit at the CSIR for a briefing. They are doing, if I may say so, excellent work. There's a team of engineers supported by the United Nations Industrial Development Organization. Let me give you the example of General Electric. They have something like 80 companies in their supply chain. Many of those companies could not provide the components in rail to the required specification at the right price and using world-class manufacturing techniques. The Technology Localization Unit deployed engineers to work with those companies to raise their capabilities, and at the same time General Electric put engineers from their plants, especially the Lake Erie plants, to work with those component manufacturers. We've had a team of people going to the Lake Erie General Electric plant in the US to better understand their supply chains. And that's an example. We've got the Technology Localization Unit working also now not only in rail but increasingly in mining capital and transport equipment. Madam Chair, where am I in relation to themes? We obviously don't have control of the carbon tax. That's a matter that falls under the National Treasury, but we are working on the upstream side of it, the National Cleaner Production Center, as we said in the data that we provided, is doing very excellent work with a large range of energy-intensive production companies to ensure that less energy and carbon mitigation production processes are put in place. I've already said we're working with the REAP office to secure higher localization. Of critical importance, Madam Chair, is building the linkages between the primary agricultural, mining and manufacturing sector, and I gave examples of what we are doing in the mining cluster. I think a big piece of work is building the linkages with primary agriculture, and we know that perhaps driven in large part by the drought, there's significant shrinkage in parts of the agricultural value chain. Madam Chair, if I may say so, you know, the idea that agriculture is not a technology intensive sector is something that we have to get away from. To export an orange requires that it's the right brightness, color, size. It has to be packed in a certain way, individually, and in a box which meets specifications. The phytosanitary specifications have to be met, and somebody's got to be representing the farmer and the packing company in the logistics and cold chain on the phone to somebody in the Tokyo market to say, what is the optimal time that I can be exporting these oranges? And so we've got to get into the space where the production sectors of the economy, mining, agriculture, manufacturing, and then linked to services are all in the same room building those linkages. Madam Chair, I've spoken to about the gas industrialization. the key challenges, Madam Chair, everybody knows them. Electricity supply constraints and elevated prices. We said this many times before. Perhaps the biggest problem is that the municipalities are charging arbitrary prices and they are loading prices onto manufacturers in order to support their revenue streams. And across the country, this constitutes a very, very big danger. And we can only keep repeating this fact. We have a unit which from time to time, as I said last year, where a municipality arbitrarily just raises electricity prices and loads manufacturing companies with those electricity prices, which should be the last thing that you do, we sometimes intervene and have intervened by bringing the companies together with the municipal mayors and the managers to work out a solution. But this is a very, very serious problem. And unless we get away from it, we will find that, especially in the light manufacturing sector, more and more companies close down because they are unable to carry the cost burden which is placed on them by municipalities. Madam Chair, we're working very closely with Transnet National Ports Authority, rather than lamenting the problem of charges and inefficiencies. How do we work together to overcome those problems? Madam Chair, I think there is, as we all know, this problem of the skills deficit. I have raised with the Department of Higher Education and Training. One of the things that the committee, in my opinion, could consider is getting a detailed understanding of precisely what the MASITA is doing in relation to the demand skills of key sectors where skills is a constraint. And that's a difficult piece of work for us because they report not to us, but they report to the Department of Higher Education and Training. And Madam Chair, the skills sector is, as everybody knows, something that we are giving careful attention to, and perhaps if it meets with your agreement, I can say a few words in that regard. We have raised tariffs on 10 items. We follow the due process, which is required of the WTO, that we can't sign off overnight on tariff increases. When the permission to, or the process in ITEC has been agreed on, the Minister of Trade and Industry has signed off the tariff increases subject to the primary steel producer not increasing tariffs prices as a result of the tariff. First thing. Second thing is the primary steel producer indicates that in some cases they've had to increase their prices not behind the tariff but because of the fact that their input costs have increased dramatically. One example of that would be the fact that at the Van der Bijl plant, ArcelorMittal used coking coal. They have to import the coking coal. When the value of the currency goes down, the cost of importing the coking coal goes up. Electricity prices go up, labor prices go up, maintenance and investment. That's the first thing. The second thing that we've done is for all the steel-intensive products that we've listed there, when the primary steel producer at the top of the commodity super cycle and the boom years was practicing import parity pricing, and it's a matter of public record, in our opinion, not adequately investing in plant and machinery. And we say that not because we sucked it out of our thumbs, but because there were repeated breakdowns of steel manufacturing production from the Vale and Newcastle and so on and so forth, there was inadequate investment in new plants and technology, which meant the company had become uncompetitive, fallen behind the global technology curve, shut down the arc furnaces at Vanderbilt, only kept the blast furnaces open, not introduced open arc technology, and so on and so forth. There was, despite repeated efforts to build a collaborative relationship with the company, and of course, in our view, reaping very significant profits from that process. Now that there is a problem, at that time, because of input parity pricing, in the designations where we have to stipulate every item which is deemed local, we deem steel, all steel, including imported steel, as local. Now that there is a very significant problem, and there's nothing that concentrates the mind more than when there's a very significant problem and companies are faced with the threat of closure, we are removing the deeming from the designation. This has taken time because we've got to work with the National Treasury. New instruction notes for all those designations have to be issued. And as we speak, my understanding is that the National Treasury is issuing those instructions. Then, Madam Chair, which is perhaps less known, we are acutely aware of the fact that we don't want to pass higher prices of steel produced in South Africa to the downstream. But this is a complex problem. If you lose your steel production capabilities, it's very difficult to get them back. And at the bottom of the cycle, there are steel producing countries all over the world that are closing down. When the market conditions improve, you will have less steel producers worldwide, and in some cases, countries will no longer produce steel. Steel producing production will have become concentrated. We could potentially lose our steel production capabilities in South Africa unless we intervene. When market conditions improve, we will have absolutely no influence on prices. We will be imports. We will be price takers of steel producers in other countries. Now, do we want that? I would argue absolutely not. But we have to try and support the downstream, which is why already in place, it's a matter of public record, one just has to go to ITAC and talk to them, that there are two rebates already in place. If you import a steel product which is not made in South Africa, you can get a rebate. And maybe the issue is that the downstream manufacturers are not making proper use of the ITAC rebate for the import of steel not produced in South Africa. In fact, yesterday I had a meeting with some of the downstream producers, and I haven't yet spoken to our marketing section, but one of the things we have to do is just literally place some adverts in the commercial press to make companies aware of the fact that there are two rebates. There's another rebate already in place, and that's a rebate for the so-called mainly re-rollers, and that is Safal, for example, which is based in the Midlands of KwaZulu-Natal, would be one example of a re-roller. If you import steel, let me get this right, it's quite complicated. Sorry. If you export steel and you added value to the steel, there's another rebate which is available for exporters, the so-called re-rollers of steel products. ArcelorMittal also have a rebate for exporters of South African steel products. So there are three rebates in place. Is it enough? No, it's not enough. Which is why we have said, as part of the ITAC conditions, we are setting up a sealed committee, which will include the Department of Trade and Industry, the Economic Development Department, and representatives of the National Treasury, and representatives of industry, to keep the steel producers honest in relation to pricing. And this is a complicated issue, because if anybody thinks it's not, they're making a very big mistake. ArcelorMittal is a listed company. To get accurate data, which we are legally entitled to, on their cost structure, which is both the iron ore, the reductants, the labor costs, the logistics costs, the maintenance and operational costs, it's not an easy thing to do at all. You have to get EBIT calculations in place. What is a fair margin for production in circumstances where other countries, including OECD countries, have put in place significant protection measures which make our 10 tariffs look like a walk in the park. Anti-dumping and a complete ban on imports from China have been imposed by OECD countries. So, frankly speaking, we're behind the curve in relation to protecting our steel industry. The committee also has to look at commitments from ArcelorMittal to maintenance and investment, to employment, retention, to technology upgrading, the issues that are spoken about, and production volumes. And volume in steel is absolutely critical, which is why we're removing the deeming from the designation. And if we can get in the infrastructure programs, and by the way, persuading companies, mining companies, for example, that use large amounts of steel, Transnet and so on and so forth, we can increase volumes for ArcelorMittal. And so, manage is an incredibly complex piece of work. It's not a quick fix. If there is a quick fix, we'd be very happy to hear a quick fix and take it on board. In fact, we are engaging with the downstream industries literally on a daily basis to try and work out a situation where we save our primary steel production. We don't pass higher steel costs simply onto the downstream manufacturers and pass the pain onto them and make them less competitive. And at the same time, we've got to do this in keeping with our commitments at the WTO. When is the Russian committee being established? I can't answer that question. The last I heard, which was yesterday, was that the ministers had signed off on the establishment of the pricing of the steel committee and its constitution will happen very shortly. Madam Chair, I don't think in my division we are directing more resources at anything else other than the steel sector. We have got a technical team of experts in the department. We've brought in engineers from outside of the department to work on a consulting basis on this piece of work. We are meeting the mining companies to look at how cheaper iron ore prices can be passed through the value chain as cheaper steel prices. And bear in mind, of course, the history of this. When the primary steel producer was receiving a discounted iron ore price, they were not passing that on as a discounted steel price to the downstream users. And perhaps at the bottom of a commodity cycle, it might be the best time to get the private sector to understand that working with government to secure a collaborative arrangement in the national interest is the best way to go.
Yes, you'll do at this point, because you would then move on to the global context and so on and so forth. I did indicate earlier that yes, we would also do the minutes to ensure we have our quorum at this particular point, which is not 10, but top half 10, and we will then move on back to the questions. I just want to check with the staff. I understand that it is tea break, so we will do the minutes, and then there is this rolling tea break. All members are aware that they just help themselves here, as well as our guests. So, as I requested and pointed out, EDG staff, we would just wait for 5 minutes to the minutes at this point. And then you have your questioning. So, I want to take out the minutes now. We're quite behind with our minutes. And we need to ensure we do have this quorum here. Right. The minutes of the 9th of March, Wednesday, which were sent back, well, now they are here again, page 1, page 2, the National Press Act. Got all the points there. Page 3. I really think these minutes, as I've said before, ought to be kept, because we will be dealing with further gambling legislation. Page 5. The resolution on page 5. The National Gambling Board's organizational structure and staff complement. A status report. We asked for that because we were under the impression we would have it fully set up at this point, the board. The status report on the National Gambling Board's lease agreement. I'm not aware, Ms. Naidu, that we have that. And this has been one of the main issues why that gambling board was dissolved, at a cost of the lease agreement. So we would like that, and we really want that distributed. Yeah, we really, well, we don't have it. Tenga, Mr. Malima, are you aware? No. We do need that, because that needs to be kept for a further engagement. On that basis, these minutes for the 8th, 9th of March, I put it to you. Yes, may I have someone to propose adoption? Honourable Williams. Can we have someone to second, or is there an objection? Thank you, Honourable McPherson. Right. 16th of March, and that was, of course, this That was in the National Assembly. 249, right. The FCR again. And the Astronautical Congress report passed. 2. The apologies on page 2, opening welcome. The briefing on gambling by the Gambling Subcommittee. Page 3. Deliberations on credit over indebtedness. I must say, journalists were surprised that we'd already started doing this in March. It's quite clear that they do not read the press releases that they're submitted by Parliament to the media. Quite clear. Three, resolutions at the bottom of the page. The committee resolved that the two reports would be formally considered on the 16th of March. On page four, a letter would be written to the NCR requesting further information on the matters raised during the meeting. Third bullet, it would seek advice on whether it could write directly to the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions on the criminality, behaviour, or otherwise of those who act contrary to the rules and policies pertaining to the credit processes. I'm not sure why we call them rules when in fact it's legislation. Legislation. 2007 legislation. That's not a rule. Right. We have someone's proposed option on that note. Thank you, Honourable Cornell. Seconded by Honourable Williams. Right. The 16th of March, when we were in adopting, we had apologies from Albert. Honourable Albert, Matash and Shivambu, and just coming to page two. Page two, adoption of the agenda, and then the meeting of the day before the points raised then, we said we would then begin to take a position and a decision. That's point three on the agenda, page two. Page three. The formal consideration, the committee deliberated on that. Committee deliberated. If we deliberated, what were the positions? Or did we just carry on deliberating for no purpose? We took a position. These were reports. These were reports that we were going to make a decision on. Honourable Balanco, do you recall that? Honourable MacPherson? DA, if you remember, the day before we had a presentation, we said we would reserve our position till the next day. Now we still don't have a position. Honourable Esterhazen, I'd like these minutes returned. I want this back within the hour. In half an hour, who's taking them back? The minutes are to be returned. We don't carry on with minutes in that fashion. Right. Now, the 5th of April. On the 5th of April, page 1, page 2, the National Consumer Tribunal on a strategic and annual performance plan. Companies Tribunal on its strategic and annual performance plan, the resolutions. The committee resolved that the NCT should submit further information on the outstanding questions, including on donor funding, mitigation, and the funding model by Thursday, the 7th of April, was done. The NCT would respond to other questions related to case management on Wednesday, the 18th of May, 2016. The committee also resolved that the CT should submit further information on the outstanding budget-related questions by Thursday, the 7th of April. I'm happy to say that happened. Right. The 6th of April, adoption proposal. Thanks, Honourable MacPherson, seconded by the Honourable Kalaku. The 6th of April. We finished a bit. I think you've got a little left behind. 6th of April. No, I think we were a bit too fast now. Right, never mind. Page 2. A long list of attendants. A long, long list. Who was all here? Deputy Director General Deloge. Opening welcome. And then page 2, page 3. We get down to the substance. The designation of industry sectors and products for local procurement, very critical to what we've just been doing and what we will be doing in the colloquium. The presentation highlighted the following key issues. Please retain these minutes for the colloquium as well, page 3. Page 3, to page 4. Page 5. Again, we're looking at that planting on local procurement, etc. We've had reference to that today. It'll be up in the colloquium as well as Bombardier. 5. Presentation by General Electric. And at the beginning there, the committee deliberated and a detailed report will be tabled for consideration. A detailed report. I'm waiting. Stop. A detailed report. Where is it? No. On my. Can't have these little private engagements. Getting his blood pressure checked. I hope it doesn't rise after this information. Now, can we I am going to accept the minutes, noting that this report is outstanding. It may well be done. And thank you, Mr. Herman, for the report. The detailed report. While you're sorting that out, Tuesday, 12th of April, page 1, page 2, revitalization of the industrial parks, and I believe Honourable Mantush is now an authority on that, page 3, page 4, the resolutions of the committee. Resolutions. The committee resolved that the DTI provided with a business plan for the revitalization of industrial parks. A progress report on the 6 targeted industrial parks, including the occupancy rate. A list of existing businesses and the operating budget for the park management. Did we get that? Responses, I remember that, on the 15th of April on outstanding issues related to the revitalisation. On the 12th of April, can we have someone to propose adoption? Honourable Yes Hazen, it's good to see a hand now. Yes, thank you. Proposed by Honourable Yes Hazen, seconded by the Honourable Mantasha. You see, this is your expertise. Bring us to the one that we were going to adopt. No, but it was sent with to you. Now, if you don't have documents, please ask the secretary. May I have those things? The 5th of April, it was already proposed and adopted. The 20th of April, last week, was it? 20th, 3 weeks ago. 19th. Right, we want to finish these, please. 19th of April, Special Economic Zones, formal consideration of the report of the committee. Now, this is a very critical one. I see most people were here. Page 2. Page 3. No, we did get that, Rose report. Page 4. Page 4. The chairperson agreed that she will submit a redraft of the introduction for consideration. Right. Honourable Albert submitted the following conclusions, etc. So we weren't adopting yet. Committee deliberated. That went on for some time, backwards and forwards. And 5.10 on page 6. The committee agreed to the new introduction as moved by the chairperson. 5.11. Chairperson submitted the report as amended for consideration and adoption. The Honourable Kalako, seconded by the Honourable Mkongi, moved for the adoption of the report as amended. Agreed to. Right. vulnerable and common?
No, I don't think maybe this is the only one I've been noticing. Page 2, 3.1. It says that Mr. Jim McPherson submitted a letter dated 15 April from AFL-Mittal South Africa to each customer, informing them at the base prices of bread and long stick to them.
See
attached letter, and then there's no attached letter.
I hear what you're saying, Mr. Hermosch. In fact, members do get that electronically. The minutes are kept separate. So it's up to members. At one point you agreed you didn't want them all attached physically. You wanted to revise your position. No. Right. Can we move for the adoption of the 19th of April, please? Yes, Honourable Williams, seconded by the Honourable Mkhonzi. The 20th of April, a lot of apologies, page 2, page 3, can we have someone to propose adoption? Honourable Bernoff, seconded by the Honourable MacPherson. Right, May, 4th of May, Wednesday the 4th, page 1, page 2. NCRE, page 3. The resolution, please remember, when you do these minutes, whoever did them, to put the word in bold resolution there. The committee resolved that the chairperson would submit a letter to the Minister of Trade and Industry requesting him to consider a legislative review of the NCA 2014 to address the limited powers of the NCR. That's been done, as you know, the remote gambling. On an official note, I see he's not here, Honourable Hill Lewis. I want to thank him again for the submission of the private member's bill and also the committee for considering it over many meetings. And to remind members, we have indicated that there are a couple of points that we would like to refer to the minister that arose in this legislation itself. Anyway, can we now, at this point, page 4, and we just need to get the decision there. We deliberated, highlighted 4.10. The committee resolved that it would formally consider the remote gambling bill on Friday the 13th of May. That is in line, as you know, with our policy not to adopt or reject or whatever, not accept legislation on the same day, but rather to give it a process. And we please have someone to propose adoption of the minutes of the 4th of May. Honourable Williams, seconded by the Honourable Esther Hayes at this time. Were you there, Honourable Esther? Yes, Honourable Williams? No, you were there, yes, you remember with that hand. Honourable Esther Hayes and proposals, seconded by the Honourable Mantash. Those were the last. I have one other set of minutes purely because we're dealing with them now. We're in the middle of them. That's it. Can you then take them across? At this point, has everyone availed themselves of tea, of refreshments? Have you? Right. We can then, with your understanding, DDG and Chief Director, come back to yourselves. And I want to remind the EED that they are fully entitled to ask questions. They are a member of the Portfolio Committee in this National Assembly and entitled to question and get a response. By show of hands, can you raise your hands to indicate a comment or a question? I'll be limiting the first round to a maximum of 3 minutes per person, the first round. Honourable Williams, followed by the Honourable MacPherson, followed by the Honourable Esterhazen, followed by the Honourable Cornell. Can we move with that show? Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. First, I just want to welcome the presentation. I've got some questions about local procurement, and I know that there's colloquium coming up in August, but I still want to ask the questions now. I'd just like to know, how do you measure success when it comes to those figures, those in on that graph? For instance, you say furniture products in government departments, 85% local content. And I'd just like to know, is there a process in place to measure that, to audit that outcome? I'll give you an example. This bottle of water, we could say it's a bottle of water, the water is 100% South African, but the bottle could be imported. Now, do you say that it's 100% South African and just ignore the bottle, or do you measure the whole product itself? That's the first question. The second question I want to know is about steel. You said that we're behind the curve when it comes to protecting our steel industry. And I'd like to know what measures are in place to put us in front of that curve, and why did we get to this position of being behind the curve? I'd also like to know, is there any other sectors in our economy where we're behind the curve of protecting them? And if so, what measures are put in place to correct that situation? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams, Honourable McPherson.
Thanks, Chair. I mean, you'll appreciate there's quite a lot to deal with. Firstly, within the RPAD document itself, and then specifically more with sectors as they detail. So I will first start off with the issue of IPAP, and then I'll move on a second round to specific issues. Mr. Shrugman, the IPAP itself or its idea is not a bad one. As you've noted, there are a number of constraints or limitations to its success, policy coherency, and so forth. And I want to agree with you on that aspect. But what the IPAP fails to diagnose, I'm not sure if the Minister fails to see it, but is the constrained inputs to make the IPAP work. Let's use agro-processing as an example. Now, you can't have agro-processing if you don't have an agricultural sector. I mean, that's quite logical. But last week I was at NAMPO, which is the largest agricultural show in the Southern Hemisphere. And to my dismay, there was not a single minister or deputy minister there, of which we have a substantial amount. There was not a single government official there, of which we also have a substantial amount. There was no stand from any government department, this one included. And it just seems odd that the very group of people that you need to make the agro-processing sector work, there's not any single person from government there to speak to them. It's also odd that the number of policies and now bills and acts are starting to come to fore that threaten the very existence of the agricultural industry, the land holdings bill, the expropriation bill, a number of bills that have been identified as problematic for restraining investment in the agricultural sector. And when I've engaged the minister on his exact response is, well, that's someone else's department, it's not ours. So when you talk about intergovernmental cooperation or interdepartmental cooperation, I think that the words are sincere, but the actions are hollow. Let's look at the oil and gas issue. Huge potential there, but the MPRDA sits in no man's land and continues to sit there. So how does IPAP focus on an industry that has no certainty whatsoever? I'll get into the fuel issue on my second arm because I know that I'm limited to 3 minutes. But the success IPAP hinders on government's ability to, or this department's ability, to take the issue of interdepartmental cooperation seriously and not hold off to that department and say, well, you know, the expropriation bill exists in public works, therefore we can't say or do anything about it. Expropriation bill is directly responsible. I want to hear the DDC's response. Okay. I mean, the expropriation bill, as an example, is at heart with so many concerns of investors, yet we keep saying, well, it's public works as well. How do you, bring together the complacency? positions of so many departments with what IPAD is trying to achieve.
Thank you very much. We then have the Honourable Guest in favour.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the challenges and the achievements or the successes of IPAD, I also want to say that a lot of listed here the government subsidies towards these industrialization programs, but a lot is also not listed, and it might be misleading. And also, you know, on these to have a 300 million rand subsidy to an ice cream factory of 600 million rand, I think it's quite extended. It's, you know, this put a financial burden on the taxpayer, the impact of these subsidies. And not only on the taxpayers, on the economy as a whole. The target of 75% local procurement means private enterprises and SOEs or state-owned enterprises. And it's also for me a concern, concerning that state entities now have in-house manufacturing, you know, and Transnet is an example of that. Transnet, the main impact or the main aim, is to achieve this with the participation of all private sectors. This is now, and then local content is not being used. They are importing most of these things from China. The steel that we touched on, I've got a big concern about that steel, ArcelorMittal being the biggest culprit in this. And then again, I know that America, for example, tariffs, TDs more than 500%, although we only have 10% import tariffs on it. But ArcelorMittal is crying, and none of this was passed down to the downstream manufacturer. The presenter said that he had discussions with the downstream manufacturers, and it's so easy then to pick this up. But it's not happening. It's 30 to 40% more expensive, the steel, than what it can be imported from China. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Guest Harrison. Honourable Colonel.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question will be on the green industries. I'm glad to see that there is a substantial investments going into solar. You know, at some stage wind farms were very sexy for good reasons. You know, it looks nice to see, it looks like progress, but wind farms are not so environmentally friendly and also not so reliable if they put in the wrong places. What I want to know, whether the DTI, maybe in conjunction with other departments, have done a study to see whether it's not better to go put out the solar way for South Africa rather than the wind farms way. For instance, you know, if you look at the Karoo, there's plenty of sunshine. Why spoil it with wind farms that is a big visible polluter if you can do it with solar that will give you reliable energy all the time and probably create more jobs?
Thank you, Honourable Colonel. Honourable
Mkongi. No, thank you very much. I just want to apologize for another meeting. I had to start to another meeting. So I arrived when you were in the middle of the presentation. What I want to get is that in this iteration of the EPAR, what is new from the previous one that we had? What is new? What is groundbreaking advance that I think this EPAR is taking us and the country to us. That is the first one. Second one is, what is radical about it? Where is a radical transformation imperative of this particular EPAR? One of the things that I can say I hear it which sounded radical to me is the transformation in the steel industry. That will break ground and break groundbreaking intervention. In terms of the question of catching the crisis, question of the terrorists and so forth. That is one. So what else can you say is radical within this process of this particular part? The third one, which is the last one. Under these circumstances that we are finding our country in, the decrease in commodity prices, the decrease in the demand of commodity prices, electricity prices, as you said, so based on municipalities and transfer prices. What could else this evaluation help us to improve the aggregate demand of the South African manufactured goods? What is the channel that this EPUB is providing us as a platform to encourage or increase the aggregate demand for the South African manufactured goods? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Nkongi. Honourable Antash.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got only two questions. The presentation informs us that they changed 13,000 employees under the Monela World Business Program. Has this got any impact in changing the features of the data of the numbers of the unemployed youth? Have you deployed them or employed them in any of the sectors that manifested those? Because we can't, it can't just statistics of any people. That does not impact on their economic status. Because we need very for money. We're not doing it for statistics. And on the program, I need a sort of a progress report in the program for revitalization of industrial parks. How do you do your monitoring and evaluation of the program? Also, my interest is in what value we get for the money that we deploy in such programs.
Thank you, Honourable Manchash. Honourable Siliami.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Let me thank the team, the broadcast from DTI for explaining the presentation. The question, the first to slide 12, Honourable Chair. You have informed here of several commitments that we made very previously, which is hope, you know, that our economy is going to be resuscitated. But the slight concern, for example, is the commitment that is set to be made by the U.S. Overseas Private Investment Corporation, who have approved funding for a $400 million solar farm in South Africa. But it doesn't tell us as to when exactly this commitment was made, so that we may know at what state of development this project is at this moment, because it gives you that hope that there is investment that are coming in. So if we could be told whether it's just a commitment that is just made, that we have approved, you know, in future this money will come, or whether it has actually come in, and that if it has been, you know, deposited, we need to know at what state of development the project is.
Thank you, Honourable Siani. Honourable Chairperson of the EDG, Coleman.
Thank the Honourable Chair, and my apologies for being late again. I'm just interested in the film incentive program, because we all will agree that this is a program that could also benefit South Africa in many ways. I understand it's about 15.2 billion spent on this particular program thus far. But what I want to understand is the extent to which black or emerging black filmmakers or producers have benefited from it. And because we all know of the Cannes Festival, how many of them really have made it up to that level, that far, and have been exposed to such an extent that today we can say they are global actors in as far as film production is concerned. This I'm asking because I just want to check the extent of transformation and extent of assistance we are giving to second question is related to the Irish Bank. I just want to start by appreciating the work done at that level, but also would like to check the level of transformation in that area. We have, as it's mentioned here in the document, that is the principal document, that there are various areas forming part of the aerospace and defense. But what I want to know is the extent of impact we are making as South Africans in as far as the questions Honorable Konki was asking. Is there any level of transformation that is happening in the space, because we know that that space is occupied by the biggest advantage. This is irrespective of having produced a lot of engineers. I do understand the issue that the DG is complaining about, one of the scarce though, but I also feel that we could also make an account of what is already existing currently, and see whether those that exist, the skills that exist in character, are able to be placed accordingly and be supported, not just placed but supported. I'm saying this, Honorable Chairperson, because even yesterday I was with one engineer, electrical engineer, who used to really support the FAA base there, as an electrical, one of the electrical experts there, helping in producing the transformers for the airports and so forth. But they are trying out of really getting assistance from government. And maybe the issue that it is just spoke of really making this information available to all the people concerned, I think that would help, because if you could, in every sector, make sure that we don't just take for granted that everybody understands that there is IPEP, there are the asset incentives that are provided, and everybody knows about that, so that we can allow and make it possible for everybody to participate. I'm sorry, Chairperson, to came up. Thank you.
Chairperson, right. Are there any other comments, questions? I do have a couple myself, as it were. And let's see, page 13, I'm off them as I went along. The technology group, oh, it was a general point. Dollars, we have, dollars, euros, etc. And it would be very helpful if we had the conversion into rand, so that, we're working on the same figures. And then on page, but that applies across the board. And then on page 23, I know what a lean mean machine is, sort of a Shakespearean, but what is a lean manufacturing and engineering? Just is the same sort of thing. That's 23, page 33 and 34. 33, I thought was a very interesting point that was made here about the key theme. Strengthen the important economic linkages between primary agriculture, mining and manufacturing sectors. I've not come across the linkages in that regard. I've come across them separately, but not that primary and production and agriculture, and of course the same in mining and manufacturing. Could you just tell us a little bit more about that linkage between the two, agriculture and mining? And then the whole issue around this deeming, etc., just want to tackle something in this regard, because it would appear as if there seem to be different interpretations on these issues. And the one that I have made a note of is the interpretation of the strategy, the plan, the policy of different officials. It appears if there are mixed signals and messages going out from different divisions, departments, and ministries. And that can create a lot of policy uncertainty if we can tackle that particular one. It can also, I believe, create a more serious problem to do with compliance in this regard. So if you would please address that. Would you want to add anything, Honourable Kalanka? No. Right.
Thanks,
Mr. Strachan, and your chief director there as well. Zuki, I didn't realize when you said Zuki, I was looking for the manufacturer called Zuki. And then I realized you were making a reference to your chief director.
Thanks, Madam Chair. There's a huge number of questions. First of all, with respect to Honourable Williams, the measurement, if I understand the question correctly, for the designation of any sector, product or subsector for local procurement is set out in an instruction note which is issued by the National Treasury. Now, let me give you an example. We designate buses for local procurement. We don't make a diesel engine in South Africa. So when Minister procures 100 buses, there would be no point in saying you've got to have 100% localization because it couldn't be achieved, simply because we don't make diesel engines in South Africa. So the instruction note sets out, it's got to be a 66% local procurement. What are all the components that are locally manufactured which make up the 60%? And then instruction note is issued. It's a complex process, by the way, because first of all, there's the verification instrument, which is the SANS, I think it's 1046, the South African National Standard for verifying the local content. That instrument is falls under the South African Bureau of Standards. There are a whole number of complicated issues there, which have been aired in this committee before and which would be aired in future. Who pays for the verification? Is it the procuring entity or the supplying entity? Is the SANS a robust instrument? If you make it too robust, you create a regulatory burden. If it's not robust enough, then people cheat the system and they say something is local when in fact it's not. So we're doing a huge piece of work on this to create electronic platforms for verification, including traceability, because that's a big issue. Steel, I was simply trying to point out that there are other countries that have deployed much more robust instruments to protect their steel industry, which if the Honourable yesterday doesn't mind me answering the question that he's posed at the same time. You know, if we didn't deploy any instruments to support primary steel production, ArcelorMittal will close down, Score Metals will close down, KFKs will close down, and so on and so forth. Do you want to end up in a situation where you have no steel production capabilities? I would argue no. So, you know, maybe with respect to Honourable Yildesen, we should put his cards on the table. If he believes that we don't, that we should not deploy any policy instruments and lead to our primary steel production capabilities closing down, notwithstanding the fact that we have amongst the world's biggest reserves of iron ore, both magnetite and hematite. That's one policy argument, but you know, I'm an official. The policy arguments must be held in the National Assembly. Our instructions is to save the primary steel production capabilities in South Africa and do so with the toolbox of policy instruments which also supports the downstream manufacturers. And, you know, that's a very complicated process, as I've explained. At the end of the day, in a recession where you've got a global glut of steel and you've got more installed capacity, capacity in China than global demand, you get a sense of how big the picture is. In circumstances of a global glut and recession, there's pain. And the role of government is to work with the mining companies producing the iron ore, Transnet doing the logistics, the primary steel producers producing the steel, the intermediaries who are responsible for the logistics chain of the steel, and the end users and the exporters. And if you deploy a policy instrument which is going to support one at the expense of the other, you make a mistake. But you have to try and ameliorate the pain in some way. But if you're going to say we must put in place a policy instrument which only supports the downstream and lose our steel producing capabilities, I think you're making a pissing mistake, because that appears to be what you're asking government to do. In relation to the third question of the Honourable Williams, please bear in mind, as you probably do know, that before 1990, in their wisdom, the apartheid government negotiated a settlement at the WTO, which listed South Africa as a developed country. Okay? Which meant that the policy space for tariffs was essentially taken away. You can also argue, and it's not my place to make political points, that that problem was exacerbated by the fact that the transitional government lowered further tariffs. So we've got a situation where the space between the applied and the bound rates is actually very small. There's very little room to play with. And so to the extent that we are deploying tariffs, we do so in a constrained set of circumstances, and we lower tariffs sometimes, or support the lowering of tariffs, which is why in the steel industry, when the primary steel producer was practicing import parity pricing, we supported an application to lower tariffs to 0%, which allows sheet steel to come into the country to support the downstream industries. But what do you do in circumstances where you are faced with the closure of these companies? I think you do what other countries do, including the US, the UK, and so on and so forth. You deploy policy measures to protect your primary steel production. But you also do so in a way that looks at the entire value chain. So we are talking to Kumba. Can Kumba provide iron ore at a discounted price? And I had in the presentation the fall of iron ore globally. But we've got to get Kumba into conversation with ArcelorMittal. Because ArcelorMittal can't do what they've done up to now, which they can discount the iron ore price from Kumba, sweat the assets, not reinvest in capital equipment, practice import parity pricing, and not pass on the discounted iron ore price. So at the end of the day, you can pass lots of regulations, but actually you've got to be talking across the entire value chain to get miners, intermediation, Transnet, the manufacturers and the downstream into the room to secure what, frankly speaking, is in a crisis. How in the national interest do we ameliorate the pain across the entire value chain? That essentially is the issue. Then the Honourable McPherson. It's news to me that the DTI wasn't at the NAMCO, and I'll take it up immediately when I get back. No excuses. The only thing I'd say is, you know, we get invited to hundreds and hundreds of events. At some point, there has to be a call on what is the priority, where do you put money, where do you exhibit, what's the balance between support in the export market and the domestic market and so on and so forth. I'm not responsible for marketing. I'll immediately take the issue up with the marketing section. The questions that the Honourable Macpherson is asking me, I think he should ask the ministers and the executive, and that should be done in the Parliament. At an official level, I pointed out already that the critical issue is intergovernmental policy coherence and program alignment. I agree with you. The MPRBA and the mining charter is a problem. It's not a secret. We said it over and over again. In the same way as, you know, for an investment, at some point the turnaround time from the Department of Energy, the Department of Environmental Affairs was a year. How do you secure investment in those circumstances? But, can't lament it. For me, it's how do you achieve the intergovernmental coordination. At an officials level, we do everything we possibly can to work closely with whatever it is. It's Transnet, the RTT office, the National Treasury, and so on and so forth. There are both complex operational issues, but they're also complex policy issues. I don't think there's a solution. If it was easy, everybody would industrialize. There are more examples of unsuccessful industrialization than there are of successful industrializers. And one of the key problems is that intergovernmental coordination and the collaborative arrangement with the private sector, which is policy certainty and risk amelioration, which allows the investment. And clearly, that's something that we've got a big problem with. With respect to the questions asked by the Honourable Eerstensen, in fact, there is no such thing as a subsidy. A subsidy is a breach of the WTO regulations. We have incentives and we have tax incentives. The incentive that you are referring to in an ice cream factory is a 12i incentive. There are a whole lot of tax incentives there. 12L for investment in respect of energy efficiency and carbon mitigation and so on and so forth. With all the tax expenditure, the tax incentives or the on-budget incentives or the industrial financing or the export credit insurance and working capital facilities, the critical question is additionality and conditionality. Additionality is, would the investment have happened even without an incentive? And we apply that. Secondly, conditionality, setting conditions for investment, which gets to the questions asked by the Honourable Coleman. Conditionality is central to all our incentives. So apart from the blank industrialist program, every one of the incentives has conditionality. Secure the jobs, empowerment, export, and so on and so forth. Do we have the capacity to rigorously monitor the conditionality across all the incentives? I say we've still got a long way to go. That has to be both regulatory. You've got to commit and declare that you're going to achieve the conditionality. But it's also about checks and going to the companies and checking. In order to achieve the incentive for the textile and clothing manufacturer, you've got to invest in new equipment, new process, new product, new plant. Somebody could go to the factory and see whether, in fact, they met the conditionality. That's not an easy thing. And so, it's got to be monitored very carefully, and I think we've got some way to ensure that there is monitoring. At the end of the day, there has to be good faith as well, and private sector has to commit to the partnership with government. I agree with you, secondly, with respect to Transnet Rail Engineering. The issue of whether Transnet Rail Engineering will become an original equipment manufacturer itself, or it is responsible for managing the procurement which is the responsibility of the original equipment manufacturers, Bombardier, General Electric, China Southern, North Rail, and so on and so forth. That's a big policy debate. If you get the Department of Public Enterprises and Transnet in the room, I suspect they will make a very strong case for Transnet Rail Engineering to be an OEM and build South African capabilities in a state-owned entity. And so that's a policy debate, and you know, the ministers are responsible for the policy, and I suspect they have to answer that question. I've got my own views about it, but it applies not only to Transnet Rail Engineering, it applies to Sasol, where they are doing physical integration from running the plantation, operating the sawmill, adding value and making products, as opposed to or in addition to supporting private sector downstream manufacturing in the supply chain. Very complex. With respect to ArcelorMittal, I hope I've answered the question. With respect to renewables, by the way, the chief director should come in here. I think we have to supply you with the information. My information is that there's a very strong bias towards solar. With respect to the Honourable Mbonki, perhaps it was unfortunate that you did come late, because we made the point very strongly that each iteration of IPEP is not something new. It's building very carefully on the achievements in autos, clothing and textiles and so on, bringing in new sectors, bringing in new incentives, working closely with the private sector and so on and so forth. If there is a radical new way of achieving industrial development overnight, we'd be very happy to hear what it is. Actually, industrialization, as I said at the beginning, is a very slow and complicated process. Most countries have failed to do it. The recent examples of successful industrialization are Vietnam, Thailand, on the African continent, Morocco and Ethiopia are achieving significant industrialization objectives. And that's all about learning by doing, working in key sectors, cascading the experience of those sectors into other sectors. Ethiopia started with agro-processing, they're moving on to electrotechnical, they've got a gas-based industrialization strategy in place. Frankly speaking, there's no fake magic formula, there's no radical blueprint for doing this. In South Africa, the complexity is even more, because you've got to achieve transformation, equity, at the same time, and address the deep structural problems. Unemployment hovers around 26% for the last 20 years. We haven't got over it. The deep structural problem is the skills. We're not responsible for skills, by the way. And Honorable Coleman, we do not place engineers. We're not in that space at all. One has to ask the Department of Higher Education and Training and the MERS CETA, which is why I suggested the committee could engage with the MERS CETA about where there are skills shortages, mismatches of skills, and what the operational processes are for ensuring that where there are skills shortages, there is product take-up of graduates, but in our view, more importantly, demand-side measures which are put in place to support the skill set shortages in key sectors. Aggregate demand, in our opinion, can only be raised in two ways. One, through public procurement in the domestic economy, or private sector procurement in the domestic economy. We put in place for the first time in 2010 raising aggregate demand through private public sector procurement in the designations, the CSDP and so on, competitive supply development program and so on and so forth. It's a slow process. I think considerable progress has been achieved, but it's a long way to go. The other way to raise aggregate demand is for the private sector to localize, which is why we have things like Buy South Africa, Crisis South Africa, and so on and so forth. Is there progress in that regard? I would argue there isn't. If all the health companies could commit to buying pharmaceuticals locally, if all the mining companies could commit to local procurement, if all the telecommunications companies with their multi-billion procurement programs could commit to local procurement, of course, if we don't produce it, you can't buy it locally, then we would have a sea change in the economy because you're raising aggregate demand. My view is that that's the key way in which to support SMEs, because unless you raise aggregate demand, you can't have the formation of SMEs. If there's no demand, SMEs can't create their own demand. The other way in which, and it's only the state, and I would argue large industrial development, led by big companies, including multinational companies, that raise aggregate demand through local manufacture and the supply chains and the downstream value addition. Of course, raising aggregate demand is also achieved by exports. Now, our export basket is very small. There are few companies that are exporting, and they're exporting very few products to very few countries. This is why APA 2016 puts on the table the fact that we are creating an export or revitalizing the export councils, the SEZs. We are creating an Export Africa Export Council. We are working on better support for export companies. We are working on supporting existing exporters and potentially export-ready companies across the value chains. Our exports in autos, chemicals, agro-processing, mining and transport capital equipment to Africa has gone up steadily. That's a big opportunity that we have to build on. So on aggregate demand, I think it's central to what we do. Honorable Mantash, the Monyeta program, Zuki's going to correct me, we'll give you the figures. I think it's something 90% of the people who are trained have found jobs, as in the call centers. It would be nice if it was 100%, but it's 90%. The key to the business process services is that there's a close working relationship with the private sector. In fact, the business trust, I think it's the business trust, helped design the incentive with the presidency, the department of, DPME, monitoring and evaluation, has evaluated the Monyeta program and the BPS incentive, and the evaluation was very positive. It goes without saying that there are transformation and the economic development criteria in all of the incentives deployed by the DTI, with the exception of the fact that where there's a global equipment manufacturer or a global company, VW or Mercedes-Benz, these are global companies listed on the Stuttgart or London or New York Stock Exchange. We won't get the investment if we insist on equity provisions in those companies listed abroad. Therefore, there's an equity equivalence instrument. It doesn't fall under me, it falls under our empowerment and enterprise development division. And there is significant progress there. The minister recently launched the supply program for VW, which I think is 100 companies, and in that supply chain, I speak under correction, my recollection is that slightly above 40% of those companies in an automotive supply chain are now black owned. There's progress, much more has to be done. With respect to the industrial parks, it doesn't fall under me. Zuki might be able to answer it. I'll leave that to her. With respect to the questions on the question of investment into solar, my understanding is that that investment has taken place. So the investments in the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program are tenders which are put out by the IPP office. Companies bid for and secure those tenders to invest in energy generation, mainly solar, but also wind. Hopefully going forward it will also include fuel cell technology. In those tenders, the critical issue is to stipulate localization requirements so that we raise aggregate demand for the components in solar. Whether it is making the turbines or the thin solar panels or whatever the case may be, in order to achieve labor intensity, you have to manufacture the components. And our local content has been small because it gets back to the question of intergovernmental policy coherence. Initially, it was suggested by the IPP office that there would be no local content. Actually, we've worked with them steadily, not by shouting from the rooftops, but by working with them with respect to raising local demand for locally manufactured products. And so in the gas RFPs, the request for proposals to import gas, and then the gas independent power producer programs, localization will be very strong. And that's because the spillovers. We produce a lot of the capital equipment for gas, whether it's, you know, the valves, the piping, the transformers, and so on and so forth, the chemicals and so on and so forth. Renewables is a new sector, so it started from zero. And, you know, the process of building up local content can't be an overnight process because you've got demand problems. Demand goes up and down as a tender is adjudicated, then falls. So we have to work with those companies, as an honourable member and Congress, and pointing to your exports can then smooth demand for local manufacturers. And so that's a critical issue. The questions by Honourable Coleman, and maybe Zuki can help here. The film incentive doesn't fall under us, as in all our incentives there are black economic empowerment and transformation requirements, but in addition to those, as everybody knows, we put in place a black industrialization support program, which is support with strong conditions for black-owned companies and entrepreneurs. With a very specific incentive, and the IDC has also put in place a set of measures to support that program. In aerospace, I don't think we have a lot of capabilities, by the way, at least Danel. Danel produces components for the aerospace. They are also capable of systems integration. since, as we know, they produce under Project various aircraft, including the Royal helicopters. But as we speak, Danel does not have the capability to make an aircraft. They make components or they integrate systems to assemble aircraft. They did. And then there are a few other companies, which include Aerosud at the Centurion Aerospace Village, that also produce aircraft. So to the extent that we support the private sector companies with incentives, our conditionalities for transformation apply. With respect to the Honourable Chairperson's points, we beg your pardon if we've put rand and dollar denominated data, we just need to fix that up. And Madam Chair, so-called lean or world-class manufacturing is a whole topic in itself. It includes applying the latest technology. It includes issues like just-in-time supply, because big agglomeration, if you're running a plant that's assembling a vehicle, you don't want huge inventory. The supplier literally comes on a daily basis, just ready to go onto the assembly and the production line. It includes required standards to global specifications, ISO standards. It requires being price competitive globally. By the way, it also implies the fact that manufacturing in key sectors is becoming increasingly less labor intensive, and that's a big problem in automotive, because the actual assembly line is not very labor intensive, it's the supply chain which is labor intensive, and unless you apply world-class lean manufacturing principles, you are not going to be able to supply the OEM with the components. But perhaps we can do a separate presentation. Madam Chair, the linkages on the production sectors, I mean, it's absolutely critical. The examples we've given are mining and agriculture. Government works very often as if these sectors are different. And in fact, intergovernmental coherence is the key thing. The National Development Plan says we should be exporting tradable services, and we agree. And, services is a big export potential, especially into Africa in brief engineering and construction. But at the end of the day, the services sector is supported by the primary production sectors, which is the key point. I agree with you, Madam Chair. The mixed signals around designation and the lack of policy coherence and program alignment is an absolutely critical thing. I agree with the members who are raising this as a problem, and it's got to be fixed. My colleague will forgive me if there are any things I left out, perhaps add with your permission.
Yes, so we've got the Chief Director of Industrial Development Division, Ms. Inc. Hi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'll just add to some of the responses that the DDG raised. In terms of the question on support that the department provides to black emerging filmmakers, in 2014, the department, in conjunction with the National Film Foundation, they launched a scheme, a support program, which was just targeted for your black emerging filmmakers. And I think this was born by the need, by the fact that a number of our black filmmakers are not catered for under the architecture that we have within the film incentive program. And just to give you examples of the support, for example, last year we we supported about 30 imaging images that were taken to the 10th festival, just to give them exposure in terms of what are the standards and the expectations of the international market. And there's a film which was screened, two films actually. One was screened last year, which is Ayana, which was screened at the 10th Film Festival. It was supported by the department. It was produced by Black filmmakers, and one which was really successful in 2016, which is called The Happiness is the Four-Letter Word. Those are some of the films, but this is not an exhaustive list. If we want further information, we can provide additional information in that regard. Honorable Manager, with respect to industrial parks, this is not within the ambit of industrial development, but what we can mention is the fact that the department has set aside about 189 million towards the revitalization of these industrial parks, and about 6 of them have been targeted for this financial year beginning first of April. I think we will ask colleagues to provide more detailed information as to when, because they have staggered the launch of this. They're not going to be done all in the same period. And obviously, they're focusing on your your TV businesses, because a lot of these are in those states. Just to add on the MIEJA Regional Work Readiness Program, I think the program and its nature development, it puts emphasis on the partnerships between the private sector and the government. When these animals use go through the training, the private sector has to make an undertaking that they will absorb these trainings. As the absorption rate is higher than what you'd expect, the 90% that the DG mentioned. Honorable Mr. President, you touched on the issue of intergovernmental coordination in agro-processing. You cited this as an example. The department commissioned the data last year, and it also pointed out to the issue of intergovernmental coordination as being a key hindrance in us realizing the potential that the cultural sector presents. One of the key action programs that we are looking at in this financial year in Agro is looking at the systematic alignment, where we're looking at bringing together the Department of Agriculture, looking at rural development, we're bringing in small business, we're also bringing in the Department of Economic Development, where we're looking at putting more emphasis on overcoming the fragmentation of our interventions across the various government and the various spheres of government, because some of this fragmentation is visible in that. I think that's all.
Ms. Inkpai, thank you very much. I know there are a couple of members who want follow-ups, right? I recognize yourself, Honourable MacPherson. Not 4.5 minutes, please. Honourable Esther Hazen, Honourable Williams, Honourable Mkongi, Honourable Albert. And as I said, this time round, if you took more than 3 minutes, must please come down to 1 minute.
Sir, with respect, you know, I need to deal with the steel issue now, and can't see with that imminent. Do you want me to deal with it separately then? Okay. Then can I just ask for that report that was commissioned, because I'd like to see that. I think that would be very interesting reading.
Well, yes, Hazen.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, if we call it subsidies or incentives or grants, or it doesn't matter, but I still say that some of the key achievements on this reading, if we fail to mention the extent of the state incentives then, and the financial burden on the taxpayer. China is the second biggest economy in the world. China produces in 2 days what South Africa can do in a year. So we I'm not saying protect the downstream or protect the steel importers. I say that the downstream didn't benefit from ArcelorMittal agreement for that 10%. So they were part of the agreement, ArcelorMittal, but the downstream manufacturers never benefited from that. South Africa, for instance, all steel is value added to it. It's in cold or hot rolled coils. If South Africa exports, for example, we exported iron ore. Half of all our export 2 years ago was iron ore to China. Now it's over 50%. So we must look after our own interests as well. South Africa must look after our own interests as well. And industrialization can only be achieved if we not go to regulation on regulation. We must look at corruption and an environment for private sector to flourish. And we must also, this can only be achieved with all our citizens involved, not only some. Otherwise, the national action plan will be only that, only a plan, and it will remain only a plan. Thank you.
Honourable, yes, Honourable Elvis. Your apology was noted, but it was a little excessive for me, and that's all right.
Madam Chair, it was beyond my control due to flight schedules and traffic and accidents on the highway. So I missed my presentation. I apologise for that. I would just like to know a little bit more about the power cogeneration strategy that you have in place. It has become quite abundantly clear that Eskom is not able to deliver the capacity that they should deliver, and also there is a move in line with that where more and more people are not using, or customers are not using telecoms facilities, Eskom's facilities, and that's due to the fact that they are generating their own power. But having said that, there are large companies that have become known, that's become known to me, that are going to close their doors, distributors and so forth, because of the power pricing. And it's going to aggravate the economic situation in South Africa. There's going to be many job losses and so forth. And I think that the GTI has a special purpose to play together with the Ministry of Energy on the one side and the Ministry of Public Enterprise on the other side, to make sure that we have sufficient cost-effective power to generate our economy and to use our economy. And what else do you have in place with regards to that? It's becoming a very, very serious problem. Thank you very much.
Honourable Elvis. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to follow up on what was said about the tariffs and the fact that during apartheid, or just at the end of apartheid, the apartheid government negotiated with the WTO for us to get a developed country. And you keep hearing this is a hindrance to our development, in fact. And could the department, in writing, perhaps later, give this committee a report on how would South Africa move from a developed country in the eyes of the World Trade Organization into a developing country? And if we were to move into that direction, could we also have the pros and cons of such a move? Because in order for us to fully protect ourselves, we seem to be in a business by being a developed country. And I think that we should start looking at, if an illegitimate government like the apartheid government was, can do that to us, why can't we just, you know, go back to where it should be, which is a developed country? Thank you.
What you mean, then, just clarify it?
What I mean is, we're recognized by the world as a developed country. Why can't we get the world to see us for what we are, as a developing country? And what are the pros and cons of doing that? Thank you.
Honourable Williams, Honourable Mkhongi.
No, I just want to thank Mr. Strachan for his answer, particularly on the question of trying to increase our aggregate demand. Now, the issue that I see as the serious problem is the question of the intra-governmental collaboration, which could be the key to the success of nationalization. Now, you have collaboration with the agriculture through the Agricultural Policy Action Plan. If you can give us the success of that plan and what can we learn from it, that we can do with other departments. Because if
the APAC is successful and that collaboration is successful, we can use it, you know, as a negative for us to collaborate with the department to make sure that we succeed. Two, one of the examples you are putting, you're saying that internalization of EPUB is an anchor of the 9-point plan. And you see it from its own successes through the infrastructure development. So also that lesson, all of that, is difficult for us to replicate to other departments to make sure that they are 100%. One of them is the question of the disjunction between the mining charters and the question of the Mineral Act. And what can we transform? Taking experiences from other collaborations that we have with Africa and also with infrastructure development. The complicated one, is this relationship between the upstream and the downstream. And we are putting it very clear that we cannot compromise the primary production capabilities of the country. So we need to protect that. But at the same time, not hindering in the progression development of our downstream necessary. Now, this thing is very, very complex. I just need a simple explanation of this relationship. Because when I attended this committee in 2014, I found that similarly the portfolio committee and the department was moving to encourage downstream manufacturing as an anchor to support creation of jobs, inclusive economy, and other related priorities of the state. But now, if we change, we're saying we must balance the upstream manufacturing and the downstream. So can you simplify that for me? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mkombi. I'm looking at members in general. Right. Just like a very concise response, Mr. Strachan, because we want to focus and spend 10 minutes purely on the steel, the issues that we further want to engage on, if I may put it that way. Right, thank you.
Madam Chair, it's difficult to answer the Honourable Estes' question and with all due respect, I think he was making a statement rather than asking a question. My only answer would be...
Looking at you, Honourable Estes, and it sounded like a broader statement, but the implicit of me, I thought, was a question. Could you repeat it?
Madam Chair, thank you. I actually responded on what my first question, on what it was said.
No, I think that's how we accept it.
Okay. My only point would be if you remove incentives for autos, you'll go the way of Australia. Close the last factory. Or, by the way, Minister makes this point. New Orleans is now attracting more firms, production, not pre or post production, but production, than Hollywood. For the simple reason that they've got an incentive in place. Our big problem in film, by the way, is that pre-production is done outside and post-production is done outside. How do we get pre- and post-production and all the filming done in South Africa? But by the way, doing the filming here, the economic multipliers are very big for all the sets, the food, the uniforms, the costumes, all of that kind of thing. So we mustn't make the perfect or good the enemy of the perfect in this case, and we must just try and build on it. The issue raised by the Honourable Albert, no, I don't want to duck the question, but that's a question that should go to the Department of Energy, ESCOM, and the Department of Public Enterprises. From where we sit, we see own generation beginning to happen, which is different to co-generation, because co-generation implies a connection to the national grid and a take-off arrangement so that when a producer of energy pumps energy into the national grid, they pay for that. I think it's another area where policy coherence and certainty and a clear strategy going forward has to be mapped out. Are we responsible for it? No. are there big problems in relation even to, in our understanding, connecting the renewable energy to the grid? Yes, there are problems, but those, if I answered those questions, I would be getting into difficult terrain because you need to ask them to other departments. With respect to the Honourable Williams, again, I'm not ducking the question. You know, I'm not responsible for trade. Tariffs actually falls under ICAID and ITAC. I think the best way of approaching this matter is to ask in writing for a written analysis of the question that you're posing, and the very big brains in the room, Xavier Karim, Faisal Ismail, and the minister himself are much better placed to answer the question. The ATAP, we have, Honourable Nkonki, we have participated in working with the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries in relation to the ATAP. My understanding is that there is a agriculture PAKISA being prepared for, and we are cooperating as much as we possibly can in relation to the preparations for the agriculture PAKISA, and of course there are very alarming signals from agriculture, as they are from mining, but perhaps the most alarming is employment on the right hand side of the graph, which is going south very steadily. Agriculture investment has been going south. Interestingly, agriculture exports, which are, I think, into value-added exports, especially to Africa, pulled by retail expansion to Africa, are going up. And so, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. But the question is to secure the policy coordination and program alignment and policy certainty going forward, including in relation to the issues raised by the Honourable MacPherson about the various bills. Then in relation to the value chain, I think our approach is informed by the following. Under previous governments, industrialization actually was driven by the mining companies. If you look at the history of South African industrialization, especially Anglo-American industrialized, and they industrialized upstream because they needed chemicals, they needed lift shafts, lift elevators, drills, etc., etc., which is why prior to about 1995 you had massive horizontal integration between the mining companies, Anglo-American, which owned AECI, the chemical company, it owned all the supply companies. Downstream, very little happened. And the downstream was energy intensive. So massive steel production at what was then ISCO. You know, in Richards Bay, the aluminium smelters, Bayside and Hillside, one of them is partially closed, they use the same amount of electricity as the whole of Johannesburg in one day. So our, historically, under apartheid, our industrial growth path was driven by mining companies upstream, and downstream it was very little value addition. It was energy intensive, carbon intensive, energy industrial complex. The structural problem. We got to support the upstream, which is the mining capital equipment in particular. But downstream we've got to get beneficiation, which isn't energy, carbon intensive, low value addition in steel and you know, chemicals, processing. We've got to move to adding value in downstream complicated value addition, whether it's in autos, electrotechnical areas, and so on and so forth.
I just want to remind you we need to finish on this to just give steel a focus. It's of course passed, but the Honourable Pellman, I overlooked her, are you, because it was on the film industry, which I thought could be raised now, even if we get the response. So you have a very interesting point there about labour intensive and the rest. But what I'm going to ask DG Strachan is if we can just ask Honourable MacPherson to just expand on the point. We've already been dealing with steel and we have addressed a number of the issues that you want to raise, so will you now deal with the remaining ones? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the committee for giving us this opportunity. Ms. Strachan, at the beginning you said that we can't have a situation where policy inputs protect the primary steel producers to the expense of the downstream or secondary steel producers. But unfortunately, that is exactly what is happening in the case of ArcelorMittal. And the downstream or secondary steel users are effectively being asked to clean up ASTA's mess, as you had yourself described, over the number of years, lack of investment, and so forth. And so when a statement came out from the department on the 28th of August, it was very clear as to what those conditions were for the tariff protection. And I will quote them for you and for the committee's benefit. There will be no price increases for steel products in question as a result of the tariffs. AMSA will invest an additional 250 million rand in its colour line, and Sapol will invest an additional 300 million rand in its metal coating line in 2017. IPAC will establish a committee comprising of the applicant, downstream users, the Department of ETI and Economic Development to monitor the impacts of the changes. It also goes on to say that IPAC will initiate an immediate review of tariff dispensation in the event of a default, which means any of the listed conditions, should they be broken, a review would take place. Now, since January this year, AMSA has initiated 4 price increases. The 4 that I'm aware of. Which seems strange when one reads a further media statement from the Department of the 5th of February that said it is of extreme importance that tariff protection measures for primary steel producers do not result in higher steel prices being passed on to the downstream intensive manufacturing sectors. These sectors are labour intensive, and any measures which might erode the competitiveness of this sector must be avoided. And it's for this reason that government is carefully weighing up the basket of measures, etc. Now, the idea of a pricing committee was never really explicitly spelled out in August, but it's something that has hung around in the air since actually February last year, and that is depicted by the article that is attached to the documents that you have from the Business Day, where it said that a proposed pricing committee or task team would monitor ArcelorMittal's implementation of pricing principles that have been agreed to with the state. We don't know what those pricing principles are. We don't know if that pricing committee has ever met, and what its terms of reference are, and what discussions have taken place following from that. But what we do know is that I wrote to ITAC on the 24th of March asking them if they would initiate a review after the repeated violations of AMSA. And colleagues, I have not received a response 8 weeks later to that from ITAC. They have just refused to respond. Which means, at the end of the day,
Normally, EMSA, Mr. Strachan, give 2 weeks' notice to the downstream steel manufacturers to implement their prices. They can then only pass those on in 3 months' time. You can understand that this is a huge problem on their cash flow books. It's also more of a problem when items like cutted steel, which were solely imported mainly from China, and only a little bit of that was made by EMSA, they have said to their customers, EMSA has said to their customers, that we will only give you what your historical offtake was from you because we cannot produce enough. Now, any customer that didn't buy from EMSA today can get nothing, and they cannot import the item because it's too expensive because of the tariff treaty structure. And I put it to this committee that the only person that is benefiting at the end of the day is EMSA. They are benefiting from exorbitant prices, they are benefiting from tariff protection, and they are benefiting from rock-bottom iron ore prices, which is the input costs. They benefit on every single level if the downstream manufacturing sector benefits in no way whatsoever. So when you say that everyone needs to feel the pain along the value chain, it's only one side at the moment. Now, I know, Mr. Strachan, that this is not, that a lot of these questions you can't answer because there are political issues or some of the issues you may not be aware of. But what I do take exception to, Chair, is that the Minister in his budget vote, and as said on the Hansard here, that he was prepared to come to this committee to deal with this issue, and he hasn't come to deal with this issue. He's left it up to Mr. Strachan to come and defend the position. And that's unfair on Mr. Strachan's defense. Now, here I'll conclude if that's all right, because I know you want me to. We have a steel crisis. We all recognize that. I'm not saying that the primary steel producers should be left to fend for themselves. But what I'm equally saying, what the committee should be saying, is that the secondary steel producers should not be being forced to take the pattern that they are at the moment. And as well such time as the review is initiated, or EMSA is told by the committee of the government to stop what they are doing, the crisis is going to worsen and the job losses are going to deepen.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. I gave you 6 minutes. Honourable
Yasser Hayes. Chair, I just want to say, further to what was just said, that I actually couldn't agree more. We said it in the House, in motions and questions asked, and member statements and everything. And nobody has actually answered on that. EMSA is getting away with murder, excuse me, in this country, and there's no consequences. We actually got a presentation today, so I don't think who must answer it then. That these questions must be answered. EMSA is now pushing for another import tariff. EMSA is benefiting the dump spill from China here at the moment, and they're pushing for another tariff. They, using America as an example, who just lifted their import tariffs from China from 200% to 500%. EMSA is using that. It's ridiculous to think that we can even do that. I don't know when there's going to be any consequences to EMSA.
Thank you, Honourable. Honourable Kalaku, followed by the Honourable
Akongi. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think this matter is actually an issue which in this committee we have been very much concerned in dealing with. But I think as I was following the presentation, especially on this particular issue, when the DDG was presenting to us, on all sorts of measures which have been implemented to address the issue. To me, I think Williams was really doesn't follow. You know, previously we thought this resides only with TTI. And when we saw statements, we thought that is an issue of TTI. But at the same time, the involvement here of the EGT and also seemingly the committee to me is under the reins of the Minister of Economic Development. So I think to me, to answer, because these are questions which we are concerned about, because they affect our economy, in fact they affect even the program of the department on local procurement, on industrialization, and also on economic development in the country. So to me, I think we'll have at some stage so that we know what is this committee actually doing and what has been done previously. Because really, agronomical is really getting away here with precisely because I would call it a blackmail. Because what blackmail is that your economy, once you start implementing these measures, as we're discussing here, we pull out, you lose all the knowledge you have been having, and you are forced to report. But I think the comments which have been put into place, we should, I don't know when, can we interface with them. Lastly, jointly with our sister committee here, the economic development, to really get into the crux of the matter and deal with the matter itself. So that also we can make suggestions. Because you see, the indigenous said countries, the OECD countries, have put measures to actually fight this dumping of steel from China and especially China. We're not able to do that. It will be important to how do we maneuver around that if we're not able to do that. And why are we not able to do that? So to me, I think we need, because you said the minister actually is in the process of consulting this committee, that is the Economic Development Minister, which is composed of the DDI and EDT plus, the industrial stakeholders. So I think we need to interface with that. It's more important to do that for Chair.
Yes, we have been told about that committee, and it really has now gone beyond time. We need to reduce all those extensions and get a response.
No, thank you very much. I think I want to take from Comrade, I mean from Honorable Galang. We raised this thing because it was a concern, because this thing of the steel is becoming, is a national crisis. And I think it should be treated like that. And then we articulated our position that the UK has taken a position, their parliament has taken a position on this program, and we also need to take that position. So I was going to propose that this process, this matter should process, through the chairperson, because we agreed in the last meeting that we need a national debate on the matter and what are the possible interventions. One, I agree with the DG in his presentation. You are clear the question of arranging the pay in the pension. But the argument is also holding that this does not happen if there will be manipulation of the pricing system in relation to the tariffs, and all that pricing is being sent into the downstream manufacturing, which creates a problem. But it's against our fundamental principle of creating more jobs, of making sure that there is value addition at the downstream level. If the pricing is going to be higher than that, we propose in one of the meetings the question of the developmental pricing. What is the relationship between the interest increase and what we are proposing as this particular committee? Because this is true that I'm not sure whether to call it a double GP or a triple GP. The answer is doing what is killing the purpose of what we have been saying, that we want manufacturing and value addition to take place in South Africa, and also is going to create more unemployment in the market. So I propose that we process this matter correctly, and then the parliament takes a decision on this thing. Because the DG explained here, which was new for me, that there are three rebates that these people are catching. And if there are three rebates that others are not using, why are you choosing the downstream manufacturing? I mean, in terms of the price increment.
Thank you very much. Honourable Mkambi, last person on this issue, Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a thought on the power generation. I would just like to hear more information regarding independent generation, how the DTI is facilitating that process.
Albert, we're just on the steel issue at the moment.
Right. On the steel issue, I would just ask, well, since I wasn't here, it also helped me, if we could have a meeting again where the minister is present and ANSA is also present. The last time I think we actually spoke to ANSA was when we had an oversight visit some years ago in Vereniging. And I think it's important that they also come here to answer questions with regard to the industry's health. Thank you, Madam.
Just one addition to what we've already had, and it's already on the program, and that was with ANSA. Honourable Coleman, sorry.
Yeah, obviously I'm hearing this for the first time, some of the facts for the first time here. Yeah. I would also love us to have a perhaps a joint sitting wherein the two ministers perhaps are here and are able then to deal with the policy issues surrounding this matter. I think.
Thank you very much. This matter was always going to come up and wait until August. However, over the last 3 weeks, it's become more and more urgent that at least we get some response. So this is why you see it just being added on to IPAP and being able to deal with it in this manner. And I must say, with respect to the minister's attendance, he has been seeing more of the world as Minister of Trade, not any industry, and he's deployed on these by the President. So it's not a question of shall I or shan't I. He is instructed as a member of Cabinet to go. So, contrary to his own intentions, he has intended being here with us last week or the week before, but hasn't been possible this week. But we have just confirmed, and we hope the confirmation remains solid, that he will be here on the Tuesday, the 16th of August, with us, and we've revised the program accordingly to accommodate that. So, because we now have added the breadth of this about a joint meeting, let's look at that as well. So what I'd like right now, because we do have to conclude this matter, it's not a matter of concluding it, that is the wrong term. But at this point in time, can you give us a very short response in 2 minutes so that if there's anything you can add and it could be more helpful to put page together on the tariffs, because I think if we had a timeline, you see, Honourable MacPherson, you yourself have got this timeline in inverted commas. It would help all of us. Here is the timeline. And I've expressed this myself, the concern that we have in this committee, that, you know, as for the middle, does seem to get away with things, and we must, whatever we do now, ensure that it's got conditionalities attached. I'm not a believer in conditionalities, but when, you know, they say a prisoner keeps on slipping out of chains, you've got to think of something else. Okay, right, Mr. Strauss.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a few context issues. You know, I suppose an apology that the Honourable Member didn't receive a response to his letter to ATAC from me would mean nothing because ATAC falls under EDD, not us. Similarly, the processes of the Competition Commission fall under EDD, not us, and they have a statutory independence of government, and so one needs to protect that statutory independence and the integrity of the Competition Commission, which reports to EDD. But Competition Commission issues are not unrelated to this problem, because it's a matter of public knowledge that it's before the competition as well. And then the establishment of the ANSA committee, that falls under the Minister of Economic Development. When I inquired, in fact, on Sunday, I was informed that the ministers had signed off on the committee. When I phoned this morning, there was some uncertainty as to exactly when the committee would be established. So
issues of the timeline, of the timing, of the multiple processes in play. The ministers need to answer that question. I just want to add, because there's perhaps some lack of, there's some incomplete information. The rebase for the downstream, for downstream, they're not for ArcelorMittal. So the rebase for products not produced in South Africa, and there are a whole lot of them, and the rebates for exports. And ArcelorMittal also applies a rebate. Okay? And so the commission needs to get on top of that. You know, there's the suggestion that nothing is being done for the downstream. In fact, we also engaged with the downstream to potentially support them making applications to IPEC for tariffs of downstream. In fact, none of the downstream companies have applied for tariffs. I'm giving this information because we need to be careful to put only part of the information on the table, as much as I share concerns that we have to save the primary production at the same time as secure the downstream industries. But if we put only part of the information on the table, we make a mistake. And so the downstream industries made the argument that to apply for the tariffs is incredibly costly. We could figure that it cost 150,000 rand to apply for a tariff increase. Maybe higher, maybe lower. That's a regulatory burden, especially for smaller downstream industries. Not to mention the long delays in arriving at a tariff agreement of some kind. Please bear in mind also that scrap metal is critical to this debate, because you can't only talk about ArcelorMittal. You've got to talk about the other scrap steel producers, and that includes Score Metal, Cascade, Hardwood, and so on and so forth. And many of them don't use iron ore, they use scrap metal. It was the DGI that pushed for an export tax on scrap metal. When we were not able to achieve that, there are now IJAC measures which are being applied in relation to the export of scrap metal. That goes back maybe 4 or 5 years. Actually, the scrap metal prices have collapsed globally. There might not be as big an issue now. But the scrap metal matters also fall under EDD. And so any report needs to include a clear assessment of the efficacy of the scrap metal matters as well.
Honourable Chairperson Coleman.
I think that from listening to what she's been saying, there might be a confusion in terms of the role where the ITEC, for instance, reports. ITEC is a shared responsibility between the EDD and the trade and industry. That should be clear. It is like that. EDD is only responsible for quality, and ITEC is implementation. So issues of tariffs and everything would be the responsibility of trade and industry. But I just wanted to clarify that, as I said earlier on, maybe when the two ministers are here, that should also be put forward so that much clarity could be brought.
I think the Honourable Coleman is quite correct that what we need here, and this is what's going to require the time, Mr. Stockman, as well, is that we have scheduled this next term, but as I said, we had to just squeeze in some time on the matter as it becomes so urgent. And we will formally communicate with the Minister on this matter, but also with the EDD, and also as colleagues with Chairperson Honourable Coleman, so that we work on this, as we did with finance and transfer pricing. This becomes a joint process. And we may find that
we're able to be more effective. However, this is a huge issue, and effectively, Mr. Sarkin should have had 3 hours, not, you know, not him per se, but the issue itself that could have been dealt with by both of you. And we're not yet there. This is a flagship program, and we will need to factor it in again. We are doing that, and I will indicate that in terms of the program. So what I want to do right now is to thank you, GDG Strachan, to thank the Chief Director, Ms. Inkapai. Thank you for being here. We now know who to call on as well. Thank you very much. And to address Honourable McPherson on the issue and to indicate this is clearly not the end of the matter, Honourable McPherson. And you may wish to communicate to me, which I will mean to the Secretary, any outstanding issue you yourself may have overlooked, you know, now that you've had this presentation. For that matter, all members of the committee should do that. So when we are prepared for the minister, we're able to say, these are the critical issues. And we give that information to those ministers. Because we're not going to wait any longer for this decision on the pricing committee. We're not waiting. I don't want to have it on this issue now, Honourable McPherson. I'm going to the program. Not on this issue. What is it on?
I mean, my simple question is what happens between now and the 16th of August?
Tackle that under the program, because in a way that's a programming issue. If we turn to the program right now, I have already made some changes. You've been issued this, haven't you, now? Right now. You will see that on the 16th, I don't know if you've all been given a fresh one page, they have. We swung that around to ascertain that the minister will be here. We said workshop at 11, but quite frankly, this workshop can go to 12 and we can go on until 2 or 3. So during the course of July, that will be fine-tuned. Suffice to say that the 1300 should rather say 1400 or 1500. And we'll ascertain what the issues are, because you've also asked, what about? We're now going to a joint process. We're now also looking at issues around perhaps inviting some of the stakeholders directly involved in this. Am I correct? Yes. So that's what you have there. What is this workshop? The workshop is so that when we participate in a colloquium actively, we have a clear understanding of the salient concepts and issues. Then you've got the Copyright Amendment Bill. You've got the whole issues around the, have I got the last one, yes. The submissions and so on. You then move further down to the Auditor General, very important. And the copyright should be processed by us by about the 16th, no later than the 20th of September. And the reason I think really it would have to be the 16th, so that if we fall short here, you know, in terms of the deliberations, we've got that all along. You'll see that on the 14th we continue and we finalise it on the 16th, so that it can go to half. We then also looking at the progress report on the establishment of the commission. Now, those were the critical issues. You well know, members, how our program has changed consequent upon the parliamentary program. But this is based on what we have at the moment. That's all I can say. And I would earnestly request, members, we have gone back, it will be after local government elections, to our Friday meeting. But at any time, if members believe they would prefer Thursday nights, as we did in the previous term, we can use a Thursday night until 11 o'clock. Honourable Williams, on the program now.
Thanks, Chairperson. On page 2 of the program, there's a meeting scheduled for 21st of September, which is a public holiday.
Have a more serious problem. who's here on Thursday? You know, the usual issue. Am I right? I'm looking at you honestly. No answer. Okay? They're all going to be here on Thursday. Now, I didn't get your point, Honourable McPherson.
I'll actually be in Hong Kong.
Well, there may be a problem. After a public holiday of the 21st with all your speaking engagements, you may be in an area of the country where you can't even fly back easily. That's what worries me. So that part will be revised somewhat, and what we will have to do is on the 16th of September, we will have a late day, and that means 1600. Who was misleading us? Who's this? Is that the Honourable Williams attempting to de-root us? But anyway, it's the 24th. So we're in Honourable Clarko. I noticed that not one other committee member identified that problem. Not one other. Okay, never mind, we'll have a list of public holidays for us. So that week is fine. All right. No problem. I'd like to sign that off to the Honourable Crowley, but Honourable McPherson, you raised an issue. Can you raise it here? It's a programming thing now. On seal. Now you've gone off.
My point is this, is that what is going to happen between now and August? Is AMSA going to continue to put up their prices? Can we not meet during the recess? Can we not recently convene anything? Because, I mean, that's my concern, is that there are six increases down the line. What stops them from doing another six between now and the 15th of August?
I then take this decision, but I'm looking at Honourable Kalaka as well. Right now, I don't think anyone has got a crystal ball as we sit here. And I'm not prepared to ask for one. So, I think the issue is, if I could just also see Ms. Naidu there. Sir Strachan, I think we need to ask you to deal with those issues which you said you were just outstanding in writing. I will write to the minister on this matter, indicating the tenor of this meeting and the position we have, and it's more than a concern. In fact, we are deeply distressed that this is a position, and we would not like to see a deterioration. So should there be any idea of that, we would like to be informed so we could consider calling a special meeting. Yourself, Honourable Mkongi, and that's it.
No, I just wanted to direct it to you. I know it's going to be controversial. And then how would this parliament on the question of proposing a moratorium on private credit? What is our power with that particular thing? Because this thing is disturbing.
I've just indicated we will be writing to the minister who is not in the country. Now, there's nothing more to add to that one. We are going to get a response when he is in the country, and I will assure you that I will follow this up. We then have the terms of reference for the colloquium. It's very straightforward. And we'd like to adopt these. Meanwhile, if you wish to add anything to them, we can consider that, and I will consider it as chairperson. Is that in order? And can we have your question, Honourable Albert, in writing so that we can put that to DTI for a response as well? You know, the co-generation. Thank you. So, members, I hope you're not going to trip, Honourable Colonel, because you're just ready to race up. But on that particular note, I would like to thank you. I know you're not well, Honourable Eersterhuizen. Thank you. Yeah, can we adopt the terms of reference? Someone to propose adoption. Yes, the Honourable Williams.
I move the adoption of the terms of reference, Jeffers.
The Honourable Craig, your hand is up. And the minutes of the 6th, which are now corrected, someone should adopt them, 6th of April. Honourable Calago, seconded by the Honourable Colonel. The 16th of March, the 16th of March, you were all here, Honourable Hildes, McPherson and Esterhazen. Honourable Esterhazen, seconded by the Honourable McPherson. I thank you. On that note, I know we're all going to local government elections, and I would like to wish everyone well, but to appeal to the members of this committee to behave in a responsible manner under the terms of the IEC. Thank you very much. No, that's it. Thank you, and I'll keep in touch electronically.
The person you need to be speaking to is not here. That's who needs to be behaving responsibly.